Welcome to the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast. Come join us by the tree. How does a scripture live? That's the question our guest poses for us this month in the subtitle of his talk. When a sutra is revised and excerpted over the ages or recedes from view through neglect, only then to reemerge with its authentic integrity intact, can the text be said to have a body moving through time? Or when translators, commentators, and practitioners devote their lives to protecting and nurturing the sutra, can the text be said to have a human family or an ecological habitat? And when the sutra in turn saves its devotees from disaster or rewards them with a heavenly abode, is the text then in part the agent and author of its own story? Questions like these provoke new ways of conceiving of reception history by projecting our definitions of life and biography onto a scripture. But as we'll see, when it comes to Buddhist scriptures in particular, it can be just as productive to look in the other direction, to think about how the content of Buddhist sutras might change our definitions of life and biography. After all, in this belief system, a sutra might not just have one life, it might have ongoing lives as well.
When we talk about biography, right, usually we talk about a person from birth to death, and then it's actually chronological, isn't it? My idea of biography as it applied in the Lotus Sutra is somewhat different. It's not just from point A to point B and then it ends. It doesn't actually end.
My guest is Chiu Huai Ho, senior lecturer in East Asian Buddhism and chair of Asian Studies at the University of Sydney. He completed his PhD here at Stanford with a dissertation titled Tales of the Diamond Sutra, Buddhism on the Ground in Medieval China, which formed the basis of his first monograph, Diamond Sutra Narratives, published with Brill in 2019. He's also the co-editor of the volume Buddhism and Violence and the author of articles in the Hua Lin International Journal of Buddhist Studies, Religion Compass, and the Journal of the Society of Asian Humanities. Chiu Huai specializes in Buddhist practices in medieval China and their influence on textual reception, and it's that subject that brought him back to Stanford for a talk titled The Tong Biography of the Lotus Sutra in Parasutraic Writings, How Does a Scripture Live? As preparation for the interview ahead, let me explain one major premise of that project. As Chiu Huai tells us, the idea that a sutra might have a quote-unquote biography comes from a few different sources. First, there's the 2016 book by Donald Lopez titled The Lotus Sutra, A Biography, that chronicles the reception history of the scripture as a kind of extended lifespan. Then there's the interdisciplinary concept of the object biography generally, drawn from anthropology and art history, that describes how artifacts have their own lives and relationships, maybe even their own agency within their history. And finally, internal to the medieval Chinese tradition of parasutraic writing, there's the 9th century account of the Lotus Sutra's transmission known as the Fahua Zhuangji, which Chiu Huai translates as quite literally, the biography of the Lotus Sutra. All of this together is what motivates Chiu Huai's opening question. What does it mean for a sutra to have a biography, and therefore a life? Let's head into the library and find out the answer. Welcome, Chiu Huai, to the podcast, and welcome back to Stanford.
Thank you.
I gather this is your return after 12 years, after the point where you defended your dissertation, and I thought that would be a nice place to start to talk a little bit about the graduate school project that took root here, that sounds like was the origin point of this methodology that you've then pursued through multiple projects of taking an interest, of course, in the sutras as core texts, but especially in what you call parasutraic writings. So going into this conversation, I suppose there's a grounding question of this Buddhism on the ground topic that we will get into that we should ask, which is, what is a parasutraic writing? Could you describe, you know, that corpus to us? And why did it pique your interest? Why did it grab your attention when you were doing your graduate studies here, such that it has formed an engine for you for multiple projects?
It didn't actually form like in the initial phases of my doctoral research. because the idea actually came much later. I mean, I was actually concentrating on the tales, and then we were calling it Miracle Tales. But then I tend not to call it Miracle Tales because I think it's underpinned very differently from usual Miracle Tales in a Western sense. Mm. Yeah, so I started out, it all started with actually a course with Paul.
Paul Harrison.
Yes, right. So we studied the Diamond Sutra, and then writings related to the Diamond Sutra. And then, so that's when I was exposed to the tales. And so Paul introduced the tales to us, and we read the tales. And the tales are all very interesting to me. And after serious considerations, I decided that it would be a topic for my doctoral research, and that's how I started. And I don't have a methodology. I don't know what they should be called, and those things actually came much later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that makes especially sense. The parastrike part. Yeah, and essentially, I think it's necessary to come up with this term to sort of talk about tales. And so the first thing I did was to talk about why they shouldn't be called miracle tales, because they're underpinned very differently, with a very different worldview. And the next thing is parastrike. And we tend to concentrate on, traditionally, we tend to study a lot of commentaries, writings that are directly about the doctrines of the sutra. And but then when we studied the tales of the Diamond Sutra, we discovered that the tales are not often, that most of the time, they have nothing to do with the Diamond Sutra philosophically, doctrinally. And then they are not commentaries. And then during my research, I also found that there are other writings that are very similar to these tales. They might not be directly related to the Diamond Sutra. It could be someone writing a praise on an event related to the Diamond Sutra. For example, someone writing a praise about Emperor Shen Zong, writing a commentary, but then nothing about the content of the commentary or the content of the Diamond Sutra. Yeah. So these writings are related to the Diamond Sutra. There's no explicit content of the Diamond Sutra. So these are writings that they circle around the sutra. They encourage people to take up practice of the Diamond Sutra, to engage with the sutra.
Right, so you have this phrase that comes up in your research, both with regard to the Diamond Sutra and the Lotra Sutra, of being a sutra practitioner. And so I understand what you're saying, where you're saying that the commentaries are different from the corpus of parasutraic writings that you're looking at, where a commentary presumably is saying something about the content or philosophically engaging with the propositions that are there in the sutra. Then there's this other distinction that you make, and you make this in your writing as well, against miracle tales, against jiguai, I guess. Could you say a little bit more about the distinction on that side of things? What assumptions might we bring into this if we called them miracle tales, and why would that be misleading compared to what you are reading and what you're seeing?
I think it's necessary to talk about the tales in relation to jiguai and to miracle tales, because we have miracle tales in other traditions as well, in the Western traditions as well. Mm-hmm. And then one of my question is, how do they differ, right? Yeah. These Diamond Sutra tales. And jiguai is because there are many people who actually call Diamond Sutra tales or Buddhist tales of these sorts, right? Jiguai. But they are not jiguai. Mm. Yeah. And the reason why it's mixed up with the genre of jiguai is because we have the earliest collections of Guanyin tales from the period when jiguai was actually very popular and flourish. Yeah. And some scholars, then you know they mix them up together and they call everything Zhigui, including the Buddhist tales. Yeah. So I think at least we have to differentiate it very carefully, because Zhigui, they have their goals are multiple. Buddhist tales, their goals are very directed. Mm-hmm. They encourage faith, they encourage engagements. And so this is a very obvious difference in goals, right? And I find it necessary to differentiate that. And with respect to miracle tales, miracle is how do we, actually it's a translation problem. Mm-hmm. I discussed with Paul, and Paul is very particular about translations, and I think it's a good starting point, because you have to really describe it well with a label, right? And but if you call it miracle tales, just like Western miracle tales, then we can't really find out what its true nature is, right? And therefore, I start to think about it, and then I start with there are actually some literature on Buddhist miracles or super knowledges, superpowers, and how are they related? So in the Buddhist worldviews, they are all related to practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to the superpowers achieved, and is related to spiritual attainments.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's very different.
Yeah. Could you give us some examples, just to start us off, of ways in which characters or historical figures are engaging with the sutras, as it were, sutra practitioners, or in other forms in parasutraic writings, that would be maybe neither miraculous nor commentarial, that is more distinctive to this corpus? What kinds of ways does the sutra get invoked, or what kinds of ways does the sutra get used?
Not miraculous in the usual way, right? For example, let's talk about the practices first.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
In the tales, usually the practices are related to recitation, reading, copying, and recitation being the most common. And there are tales of devotees who recite the Diamond Sutra. And one of the things that characterize the corpus that I study, usually they really encourage people to really recite a lot of the Diamond Sutra, and it's very different from the Guanyin stories. The Guanyin stories, usually you just call the Guanyin when you're in trouble. Sometimes they are not even practitioner in the first place, but the Diamond Sutra tales are usually about people who have engaged with the Diamond Sutra for extended period of time. Mm-hmm. So then there'll be different sort of things that they will encounter, and usually the stories could be very formulaic. There's a sort of like a prelude telling us that the person practiced, engaged, and recited the Diamond Sutra. There's some problem he or she encountered, and there'll be some sort of a solution. The problems can vary. I mean, it could be meeting a tiger on the way in a mountain, and then the tiger not attacking the person.
Mm.
Yeah, and or from someone surviving a boat capsize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In both of those cases, by nature of that person being protected by having undergone a practice of reciting the sutra, perhaps?
Yeah, right. So then you look at, are there people who survive, drowning?
Yeah.
Of course they are. Right. So, but then the tale is written in such a way that it prepares and prime you to interpret it as a sort of miracle, yeah. But it's a wonder, right?
Yeah.
So, but then miracle in a Western sense, and especially with David Hume, right? From his time, is usually interpreted in such a way that it's related to the powers of the great intelligence, right? And then it's usually externally applied. But then the Buddhist tales are usually internally applied, because the trigger is usually the person him or herself, right?
Yeah.
That you got to recite the sutra to call forth this things. And then there's another concept that you bring in, you know, because of the merit that you have accumulated that enable you to survive drowning. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's some matter of internal training. Internal piety is probably the wrong word, but there's a
sense of piety as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not an intercession by a deity on one's behalf or by a saint or something along those lines.
If ever it is because of the devotion, the piety, the recitations that actually call forth that help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this leads me nicely to my next question, which is sort of about, looking at the celestial versus the terrestrial, because, you mentioned humbly that you felt like a methodology or perhaps a scholarly perspective or angle was only information in your dissertation. And I take that point. At the same time, the subtitle to that thesis, about being Buddhism on the ground, is one that then returns in the introduction and opening chapter of Diamond Sutra Narratives and does seem to be a sort of motivating scholarly perspective for you, that you are staking out a way of looking at this religion and a scope about that. So can you tell us about that choice and how that commitment has evolved over time?
Yes, I mean, I actually wrote in the introduction that I think was introduced by Ninian Smart, and in response to how we take up religion and how we study religion, and it's still the case that and traditionally, people concentrate on major figures in Buddhist histories and talk about the great things that they do. But then nobody is doing research on what common people were doing on the ground. And so there's this huge gap. And of course, it is difficult to study pre-modern periods and what people are doing.
Sure.
And but I think it's possible to actually do it through the tales, especially when we have a lot of evidence in relation to the Diamond Sutra because of the Tun Huang manuscripts. We do have many manuscripts related to the Diamond Sutra, whether they are actually, like, for example, paratexts, like colophons attached to manuscripts. Yeah, and they can be studied for what people believe and what people were actually doing and in relation. So the study of the miracle tales in itself is insufficient to actually throw light on, because there's this questions of whether they're true or false. But then when you can supplement with other sources, then you'll be rich enough for you to at least make some inferences about what people were doing on the ground. And therefore, given that there's a gap, and there's an opportunity to look at these tales through other materials to sort of come up with a picture of what people are doing, then I think it's worth engaging with Buddhism on the ground, which is still lacking. Yeah.
Yeah. And I take it that's one of the things that's front and center for you when you think about now as your projects move forward, going from the Diamond Sutra to the Lotus Sutra and having also the Garland Sutra there as a sort of third point of comparison, is it seems as though as you're looking at the Parasutraic, you're also interested in these kind of structural parameter related questions about what can we chronicle almost in a quantitative sense about what we see in the protagonists of these stories and who these stories might be meant for in terms of an audience, where, you know, some of the Parasutraic texts that have maybe more to do with the Diamond Sutra than the Lotus Sutra might involve laity more than monastics or vice versa, and that might imply something about who these stories were meant for or who found the most inspiring and where the laity was drawn in terms of one sutra or another. So can you tell us just a little bit about, now that you're working on the Lotus Sutra more specifically, how you see that distinction?
Let's begin with, we can only make conclusions based on what we have, and sometimes they might not be true reflection of actually what actually happened on the ground. And I can only say based on, you know, what available evidence I have.
Of course.
Based on Diamond Sutra, because there are obviously a lot more lay representations that, and therefore, and we know based on the manuscripts in Tun Huang, there are many lay engagements, and but the Lotus Sutra Parasutraic writings, the two collections I've talked about, they're actually very different. One of them traditionally has been taken to be a miracle tales collection, but it's not. Yeah, the Hongzhan Fawazhuan. Because when I read it closely, some of the stories, there are no miraculous content. They're basically about someone who just engaged with the Lotus Sutra and then his life, that's all. Yeah. And so there's no content of wonders at all. Yeah. So they are not comparable to the Diamond Sutra collections I've studied.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but they are still parasitic writings of the Lotus Sutra because they are about and they encourage faith in the Lotus Sutra.
Yeah. If anything, it sounds like they are more distinctly parasutraic writings as opposed to miracle tales or some other designation we would give them.
No, both are parasutraic because they circle around the scriptures, except that they are, you cannot say that it's a collections of accounts of wonders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Definitely. Because not all accounts.
Even if they're compiled as such. Is there a reason why they're compiled as such?
That has got to do with the goal of the collections, because the collections, usually the compilers are very specific about what you want to achieve with the collections. And sometimes you have paratext within the collection, within the parasitroic text itself, that will tell you, right, the prefaces, the colophon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that will tell you what to expect, but it sounds like they might also mislead you in certain ways, where it's sort of like, oh, if you go forward with this, these are all kind of in the realm of the miraculous, but in fact, they turn
out to
be. I
think, when you say that they mislead you, when you are misled, it's because of yourself, I think. It's because you don't read it well enough, because, we are at a time, considering the time, right? Yes, they have papers, they still write, but they don't write effortless. Like, they don't have abundance of paper like us and pen and write easily, right? They still have to, it still requires effort, right? So they are very specific about their task and their goal and what they want to achieve, and they are very economical in the way that they write. So they have to express a lot of things with fewer words than us.
I see.
Yeah.
So just you get these rubrics that are maybe more capacious than, or to us, would mislead us, but that's because we haven't done our proper job of kind of putting ourselves back in that time.
So if you read them carefully, I think it's possible to know what they're for. And so the way that I title my stance is that the way they are titled tell you what they are all about. So Hongzhan Fawazhuan, right? So or Chuan, right? It's basically, if it's a miracle tale collection, it will tell you Ling Yan Chuan, Ling Yan Ji, Ying Yan Ji, Ying Yan Chuan. And so the title actually will tell you what you're supposed to take it to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if they don't call it ziguai, don't call it a ziguai. That's my point. Mm-hmm. And don't get mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, right, when they call it a chuan, and then or chuan, right, and then we have the fawa chuan ji or chuan ji, right. So they are already telling you how you're supposed to understand them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we can sort of try to understand them based on that character.
Yeah.
And you roughly know that it's related to Chuan transmission or Zhuan, which is biography.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a problem, right? If you were to say a biography of broadly promoting the Lotus Sutra, that would sound a little bit strange. But it might not be strange if you attend a talk
I think we'll come back to that at the end of this interview and with the talk tomorrow. So these texts are already telling you, you've mentioned in your writing that like a big corpus for you is the Tiantai patriarch biographies, right? So sometimes we are talking about biographies of specific people who have relationships to the sutras, but it sounds like you're saying the language of the titles of these texts is already suggesting to you
that these
are biographies of sutras themselves. Is that right? Or almost something along those lines?
That's my argument for tomorrow's talk, and I have to demonstrate to you how you can actually pass it in such a way.
Yeah.
But there's and now that's a problem of translation. You see, the English is very restrictive, but Chinese, right? Yeah, if you write that character, put it that character. If you can, I can read it Chuan, and you can read it Chuan, right? And Irene can read it differently, and yeah. So that's how I think it was meant to be. Yeah.
That there's an ambivalence built into the character itself.
And in fact, the collection itself, you know, contain all these different connotations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a sort of a boundary and a way. And but it's not a Ling Yanji. It's not a, you know, miracle tale collections.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so just to pause for a moment on the kinds of outcomes that do come from these engagements with the sutra that we might not call miraculous, but that are very important from a Buddhist cosmological karmic perspective. It seems like one of the things that you've hit on is not just, and I love this, that the paratext and the parameters of these parasutraic writings already distinguish them between Diamond, Garland, and Lotus Sutras, but that also there is, nevertheless, also within the content of these stories, something that's distinctive about the Lotus Sutra stories, which has to do with accounts of different forms of heavenly rebirth that are given to different kinds of practitioners based on the level of their engagement with the sutra. So could you tell us about the different realms one can be reborn into by nature of having this Lotus Sutra practitioner practice? And what do you learn from the fact that different patriarchs or different monastics land in different places with regard to this variety of engagements?
Actually, this question is interesting and important in a way that, because it actually make me think of things that I never really write in that article, and which I might not give you an answer now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but now that you bring up this, the afterlife abodes, right? Is something, you know, if you're talking about what really distinguishes these different parasutric writings of different scriptures, right?
Yeah.
This is one of them, because in the Lotus Sutra collections, you'll find that people will have afterlife, people die, and you know, or they have good rebirth. Usually it's not named in the Diamond Sutra collections, but the Lotus Sutra collections, in the Lotus Sutra collection, they make sure that they name, like going to Tushita, Trayastrimsa, right? Mm.
They're more specific about the abodes.
And, yeah, the pure lands, right? And sometimes there's comparison. For example, someone recited the Lotus Sutra X number of time, and then the parent is reborn in certain heaven, and then the parent came and said, "Oh, if you were to, you know, recite another X number of time, I'll go to the Pure Land. I'll have an upgrade," you know, and so there are this kind of things going on. So there seems to be some sort of, you know, some sort of a the hierarchy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
is it being codified in that moment as to like what you have to do to end up in certain abodes?
No, it's usually, right, because the text is about the Lotus Sutra. So the focus is always on the Lotus Sutra, meaning that how many times that you recite, and then you can have an upgrade, things like that.
Yeah.
But then because you also ask what specific things they do to be reborn into Shita or the Pure Land, right? I might have actually missed out, because you can actually probably look closer and see, for example, this story about Lotus Sutra recitations and someone being born in Tushita, for instance. How Maitreya actually was featured in the tale. So that's something that I didn't focus on in that article, and I can actually go back there. I mean, if I'm writing a book on the Lotus Sutra, I finally go back and do more refined scanning, right, of the text, and see whether does Maitreya ever even appeared in a tale where, you know, the protagonist gained rebirth in Tushita.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have a hypothesis about what you might find if you come back through for that?
I don't want to give a premature sort of, but my hunch is that basically it's still based on the Lotus. But if there are, I believe there might be a few cases that we might not be able to see a pattern, but a few cases might be able to give us a theory.
Yeah. And it sounds like what you're saying overall is the emphasis is not on the devotion or the labor of a practitioner, it's always on the power of the Lotus Sutra.
Yes.
And that power of the Lotus Sutra may not necessarily be predictable or reducible to kind of mathematical earnings of, you know, how many times you recite it and therefore get these kinds of rewards.
But the more you recite, the outcome is always better.
Okay.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So there is at least some logic you can follow, you can put your trust in.
Yes.
Okay. That makes sense. So thinking about the Lotus Sutra more generally, I do want to come back to this idea of there being a biography or a lifespan of this particular text and of the particular Parasutraic corpus as well. I know this is going to be the topic of your talk tomorrow, and to get the full argument, we'll have to take that in at length and ask you questions about it. But can you give us a little bit of a preview or an overview of sort of how you see the lifespan of the Lotus Sutra by way of its Parasutraic writings in the Tang Dynasty? Where does it begin? Where does it end? What are its phases?
Okay, let's start with the prehistory of the research. Because as I was telling you before, Donald Lopez actually wrote Lotus Sutra biography under the Princeton University Press. It makes me think about, how can a sutra has a biography? How do you talk about a sutra having a biography?
Yeah.
And then prior to that, when I was writing my dissertation, and of course I mentioned the two Lotus Sutra collection, I actually have some trouble translating the collection's name. Mm-hmm. And if you look into my book, I think you can sense some sort of it's not totally well done.
Were there other translations you entertained that you could have gone with?
I just feel it wasn't something that I was totally satisfied with, mm-hmm. for sure. Yeah, and maybe that lingers on, and then when I see a biography again, right, it makes me think about, because it all lingers with the word chuan. Yeah.
What else could that word mean if not biography?
That word is available in Chinese, and in the, if you are talking about historical writings, it usually refers to biographies of people.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So Sima Qian, he started this new Zizhuan tea, right, to apply in historiography. And so he introduced this Zhuan genre, talking about the biographies of people that he collect in his history, the Shiji, the records of the grand historian. So this is something that he sort of pioneered. And later on, these genres were taken up in various, and of course, it's also taken up in Ziguai, because some accounts of Ziguai, they comes in, the biography of people, and of course, in Buddhism as well, and became very big. So Sima Qian, in some sense, has a sort of great impact on how we write biography, and so this term is used and is applied to people. As far as I know, I don't think we talk about a biography of a, in a Chinese sense, biography of a text.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's why we have trouble when we try to translate this term, especially in the name of these two collections.
Yeah. So I hear that as the story of coming to terms with this term and this generic, this genre category. Can we say something about there being the story of the years themselves, these kind of medieval years where this Parasutraic literature is developing? Is there something like an adolescence, a maturity, an end, a rebirth? I know you write about perpetual renewal of this tradition, but in what way might it have a lifespan or a life evolution?
Are you talking about biography?
I'm talking about sort of the Parasutraic writings themselves.
Okay, you're talking about Parasutraic writings, right? You know, the Parasutraic writings come about only when people want to propagate this scripture, mm-hmm. or it started to gain some ground.
Yeah.
And then people are aware of it and then wanted to push it further, right? So it must have some sort of beginning. So
yeah.
people took notice of it. And in my book, I said that one of the reasons is because it was made available in the public domain, in inscriptions, in monasteries, and so that people can see. And that's how people gain knowledge of it, not just the monastics or people who have access to a book, but people who, you know, maybe illiterate but could see it actually, and then ask people, what is this, right? So it might have started from that sort of beginning, yeah. and then people started to collect these tales, and then that's the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where does it go from there? Once the people have hold of it, once it's a sort of publicly available text and not a kind of cloistered one.
Yeah.
What happens to the text going forward from there?
It'll be a snowball effect. You know, as people get to know about it, more people start practicing and then engaging with it, mm-hmm. and then the people start telling people, others, their experience, and then as more and more of these accounts proliferated, then they come to be compiled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then the Lotus Sutra practitioner work that we might associate with particular patriarchs or with monastics starts to be something that other people, including the laity, feel that they can participate in as well.
There's actually a distinction between the Diamond Sutra and the Lotus Sutra collections, because the Diamond Sutra, as I was saying, right, we have a lot of things, evidence, I would say.
Yeah.
But the Lotus Sutra is from what we can see, there's of course fair representations of lay engagements, but then it is much less than
the
Diamond Sutra for various reasons. Yeah. I mean, it's more extensive, more difficult for people to engage, mm-hmm. but anyway, there are still shorter versions, for example, extracts. Like a certain chapter that's very famous, the chapter on Avalokiteshvara. So that's practice, and that's a legitimate form of practice as well. And so and you'll find that in collections there's some representations of those sort of practice. And engaged by lay people as well. So in nature, it's very different parasutroid. So you can say that it's broader in its scope. It contains accounts of wonders as well as non-accounts of wonders and maybe and something else. For example, Hongzhan Fa Hua Chuan started with the category of image. So it talks about fashioning a certain landscape related to the Diamond Sutra, or a bodhisattva found in the Lotus Sutra. And then it is this fashioning is replicated in China. Mm-hmm. So it's telling the tale about how important landscape and sacred geography how important it is in Lotus Sutra cult.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is something that is totally not related to wonder tales of wonders, right? Or biography.
Right.
So this is something, so it's sort of broader.
Yeah, it's a detail that's maybe more.
And then the Fa Hua Chuan Ti is much broader, as I'll say tomorrow. Yeah. So there are other things. Yeah. But I know you're interested in, you know, history and what is the different.
Yeah, well, I'm curious about that, and I think that's maybe where we will end. Is just you know, so you take this idea of there being potentially a biography or a lifespan of a sutra from Donna Lopez, but also from within the text themselves. They seem to be suggesting that language to you. And I suppose that feels quite different from saying, oh, I have a chronicle, I have an archive, I have a history of a text, to say I can tell the story of a life of a text or the biography of a text feels quite different. And I wonder just how you conceive of that. Is it useful because it offers biological analogies of sort of like, oh, here's the maturity of a textual tradition, here's the health of a textual tradition, here's the, as you say, the propagation of a textual tradition. Is it more because it feels like it has interpersonal analogies? Oh, here's the social status of a tradition, here's the identity or self-recognition of a tradition. I guess I wonder what kinds of things as a scholar are offered to you by thinking in terms of life and biography, as opposed to maybe more neutral categories of history, chronicle?
I think when we talk about biography, right, usually we talk about a person from birth to death, and then it's actually chronological, isn't it?
Yeah.
And basically, a biography tends to be historical, more or less, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when we are talking about biography, and my idea of biography as it applied in the Lotus Sutra is somewhat different. It's not just from point A to point B and then it ends. It doesn't actually end.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of my argument. And what I want to argue is it is actually a pre-modern sort of biography written. And the idea of object biography, because I mentioned that before, you know, it's an interdisciplinary field taken up by museum studies, anthropology, who try to account for the life of an object, not just as an inanimate thing, but having agencies and being able to influence things and being an agent itself in the way that it influences people. And so from that perspective, we can actually see that there's some sort of a presentation by the compiler of Fa Hua Chuanzi in such a way, you know, presenting it in such a way that it's not a usual kind of biography of a person.
Yeah.
But then having agency, having some sort of influence, but then it's really also interesting because in the very beginning, deals with the ontology of embodiment. Yeah, how it is, and by the way, when in Buddhism we're talking about cosmic time, it's not just, you know, the time in the human world,
yeah.
And so and that very beginning is not specified, you know, with
yeah.
or in which year, but it says that the Buddha expound the Dharma, and expound the Dharma, and it's so expensive that you can't contain it. Yeah. That's but
go ahead.
You can actually put it in, you can actually do it somehow, contain it somehow. But this is always the, you know, a very Buddhist way of expressing things.
Yeah.
Not being able to contain, oh, it's so expensive, and but then you still manage to contain it for people. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it started with explication, you know, expounding the discourse, yeah, and not in just verbally, yeah, not in any textual form, but in Fa Hua Chuanzi, you will come to see that at a certain point in time, you will be committed to writing, and then you will have influence subsequently. So you can actually see that the compiler has some sort of an idea about the Lotus Sutra having agency, and it actually appears, you know, it appears according to a rhythmic theory of time in Buddhism. It actually will arise, it will matures, and then it will be concealed because the conditions are not right,
yeah.
And then it will manifest itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really clarifying. So I was thinking in these terms of biography being a known generic entity that, you know, of, like you say, describing the beginning of life to an end and then imposing that as a way of giving order onto an otherwise potentially amorphous, difficult history of a large corpus of Parasutra texts. But it sounds like you're saying in multiple ways, we actually need to think about it in the reverse order. We need to think about the ways in which that Buddhist history and that Parasutraic set of writings as changing our sense of biography. That, you know, it changes our sense of biography because we change our estimation of what counts as a living, active agent in a story. It might not just be the practitioner, it might be the Lotus Sutra itself. And it changes our notion of biography because it changes our notion of time. That this is something that is reborn across multiple generations and has renewed life and vitality and importance in a culture, not just in in the course of one lifespan.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. The way I want to close then is just to ask you, where are you taking this model, this heuristic in your research going forward? You've done the Diamond Sutra and the Lotus Sutra. Do you imagine continuing on with parasutraic writings and their biographies with other texts and parasutraic sets? Or is this starting to inspire new departures and offshoots?
Yeah, I have other ideas, but then I haven't finished because this is just the beginning. For tomorrow's talk, I'll not go into the accounts of wonders because we have no time, but I only have time to talk about why it's a biography and explain why it's a biography. But this is just the beginning because it's incomplete because this biography is supported by a system, and what I call a system is a system of faith and devotions that is actually sort of encapsulated in the categories of engagements. The collection is divided into 12 categories, and the remaining six are actually those that are related to how you engage with the scriptures. I think if you want to really talk about, because biography, the way that we have it, right, require us to look at how, it's not just how people take up, it's the relationship between the text and the people, and how do you unravel the relationship. You really have to study the accounts in these categories very carefully, right? So this collection is very big, so there are hundreds, and so to finish up, I think I'll have to really read them very carefully.
Yeah.
And as I said, they are not that formulaic compared to the Diamond Sutra. So there are a lot more variations. So which means it's harder to interpret them or to see patterns. And so it requires more effort. But I think this idea can be applied to other texts in Buddhism and Buddhist studies, for example, esoteric texts, the Pure Land text as well. Yeah, so in its application, it's very wide. But unlike a traditional human biography, which will be about the life of a person, the scandals of the person, blah, 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 the biography that you see in Fa Hua Xuanzi, as I will demonstrate, will not be the same as a biography that was the biographical patterns that you can actually see when you study other parasutraic writings of other sutra.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more work, but in its application, I think it can be done to other texts.
Yeah, that makes sense. But also it makes sense then that you'd be in the thick of it with the Lotus Sutra for quite a while because of the eccentricities and the varieties within.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, wonderful. Well, we look forward to seeing how that research evolves in the coming years, but especially how we can learn more about it tomorrow in the talk that you're going to give, a talk that we're also going to be recording and putting on our YouTube channel. So thank you so much, Zhuhui, for having this conversation with us, for explaining the ins and outs of the parasutraic corpus of the Lotus Sutra and the life therein.
Yep.
This was a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Zhuhui for joining us on the show. If you want to go into greater detail, you can watch his full lecture on our YouTube channel, titled The Tong Biography of the Lotus Sutra, or read his 2023 article for the Hualin International Journal of Buddhist Studies, titled Parasutraic Narratives and Cultic Repertoire. Until next time, this has been the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast.